Canto 10, chapter 27, text 5. Now we actually we did this text yesterday, so we will just go through the Sanskrit and English translation, and then we'll move on to text 6. Uto nutade dvetava ishatat krita. Kuto nuta dvetava ishatat krita. You don't have that one on? Which one? Did he change it? Which one do you have on? You have one. Six. Okay. Good. All right. Pita gurustvam jagatam adisho. Duratyaya kala upata danda. Itayate cha tanubi samihase. Manam vidunan van jagadish maninam. Pita gurustvam jagatam adisho. Duratyaya kala upata danda. Itaya checha tanubi samin samihase. Manam vidunvan jagadish manina. The father, guru, spiritual master, tvam, you, jagatam, of the entire universe, adisha, the supreme controller, duratyaya, insurmountable, kala, time, upata, wielding, danda, punishment, hitaya, for the benefit, cha, and icha, assumed by your own free will, tanubi, by your transcendental forms, samihase, you endeavor. Manam, the false pride, vidunvan, eradicating, Jagadish, lords of the universe, maninam, of those who presume themselves to be. You are the father and spiritual master of this entire universe, and also its supreme controller. You are insurmountable time, imposing punishment upon the sinful for their own benefit. Indeed, in your various incarnations, selected by your own free will, you act decisively to remove the false pride of those who presume themselves masters of this world. Please repeat. You are the father and spiritual master of this entire universe, and also its supreme controller. You are insurmountable time, imposing punishment upon the sinful for their own benefit. Indeed, in your various incarnations, selected by your own free will, you act decisively to remove the false pride of those who presume themselves masters of this world. Purport. The word Hitaya is significant here. Lord Krishna protects religion and chastises the wicked for the benefit of the entire universe. Foolish and faithless pseudo-priests criticize God for punishing the living entities through the actions of nature. But whether Krishna punishes them indirectly through nature or directly in his incarnations, as mentioned here, he has a perfect right to do so because he is the Father, spiritual master, and supreme ruler of the entire universe. Another way he curbs down the false attempts of the conditioned souls to establish the kingdom of God without God is through his feature as insurmountable time. It is said, spare the rod and spoil the child. That is a fact. And it is actually the Lord's mercy that he takes the trouble to rectify our misbehavior, although faithless persons criticize the Lord's fatherly vigilance. And so I would like to just continue reading on to the next verse. So here in this particular verse, Lord Indra is describing Krishna as father and spiritual master and spiritual supreme controller. There is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm not quite sure, I think it is in the second half of Bhagavad Gita, and there's a purport which is quite interesting. I remember it's on this side of the page, in which Srila Prabhupada is going through, you may be the Lord, but you may not, you may be this, the Supreme Father, but you may not be the Supreme Controller. So therefore, Arjuna has used this word. And you may be this, but you may not be this. And therefore, he has used this word. And it goes through this verse using the verse has one Jagat Pati in it. Does anyone happen to know? It's a little too vague a description, but it's where Arjuna is describing Krishna. In other words, a description of Krishna means that you will be saying his names. Just like if I say to you, you are a very responsible husband, and you are a very good brother, and you are a responsible teacher of the Bhagavatam, you are this, you are this. Each one of these, if they were given a Sanskrit word, they were translated into Sanskrit, they would become a name. We would use them as a description of somebody. We would say, this is Keshava, and he is this, 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 and this. And we would think, only one refers to your name, and all the rest are just descriptions of that person. But all Krishna's names come like that. They're all descriptions of him. When they are transformed into the Sanskrit language, they become so beautiful and so lyrical, and they're his names. So when you think about it, these are what we call these upadis, upadic designations. Upadi means 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 things you can think about yourself. If you are asked, you're given a text and you're asked, please fill in something about yourself. You would write down all the different labels about connected to you, your identity. And even it's an upadi to say, I'm not very intelligent, or I have this good quality and then I have this bad quality. We may think that the pride, you know, I am great, I am this is something. But when I think I am actually quite stupid and I'm not very good at things, somehow or other there's some credit in this. Sometimes quickly we think in this way without thinking deeply. But practically speaking, the negative aspects and the positive aspects are both connected integrally to a false identity. And so they're neither one, good or bad, whether we have a long list of negatives or a long list of positives. We're performing the same process of just writing down all these upadis, because if you trace everything you know about yourself or everything you know about someone else and you put them all down, they're all upadic designations, they're temporary. They're linked integrally to the identity that we have assumed that we are. And beyond all of this is Krishna. And he is not, his names are not like our upadic comments about ourselves. They're quite different because they're transcendental, as he is transcendental. They're not disturbed by time. I might say at one time, oh, I'm a very healthy young woman. And then later I might have to say, oh, I'm getting to be a kind of an uncomfortable middle-aged lady. And one day I will have to say, I'm an old lady who can't remember things. And all these are all relative statements about the same person, but they change and shift with time. And then we'll get another one, and we'll start again, crying and trying to move our little arms and legs. Hopefully we have two arms and two legs and not four legs, or two wings, because we would have a different kind of upadik. We wouldn't have any idea who we were then. But again, we'll get another body, and in that little body, we will be again, it will be reinforced by our environment, by our family, by our well-wishers. They will reinforce all of these things. They must be there, they must be, we must feel good. So they will give us all of these upadik designations, return them to us, and we will start again with another one. But Krishna doesn't do that. So there's a distinction right there. And here we hear three things that are that teach lessons. Can anyone think what were the three things that were mentioned that chastise and remove false pride from those who presume to be masters of the world? Can anyone think or remember what they were? Yes. Insurmountable time, correct. And there were two earlier in the purport. Insurmountable time was the final one. Yes, in what form? What forms does Krishna use to punish? Time?
Natural disaster.
Yes, nature? Yes. Yes, thank you. His incarnations. When he appears personally, he chastises. Through nature, he chastises in so many ways. We see that sometimes people can't understand a chastisement given by nature as being actually a chastisement. They think somehow or other it's a mistake, some imperfection in the way that nature works.
Like tsunami.
Why this is, and then they go to work to try to understand the causes and effects, and this is caused by this and that's caused by that. Then they put it aside. So he also appears in incarnations, and of course very few people that we know have been fortunate enough to receive him in the form of his incarnations. We try to make as many people as possible fortunate to receive him in his incarnations. What is the incarnation that he comes in, especially in the Kali Yuga? The holy name. Yes. By the mercy of his incarnation as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he comes in the form of his incarnation as the holy name. So when we go down the street chanting, people, they unconsciously are receiving him in that form and imperceptibly making some change on them. On some subtle level, there is some change. And if it's perceptible, just as sometimes somebody becomes very angry, I was looking just recently at some newspaper articles that my mother had saved from the early days, and one of them was about one devotee called Sanak. And Sanak, he and his wife Chekitana began the temple in Burnett Street. And I don't know the sequence, I'll have to give them for archival use for the temple, but Sanak was just getting out of prison after two weeks in prison. They had imprisoned him because he was manifesting the holy name and having kirtan, and so it wasn't allowed in Melbourne. So yeah. Melbourne was so rigid that it, Melbourne's name enters into Prabhupada's purports. It's one of the places in the world where the holy name is not being well received. But time and the sincerity of devotees has pushed through that barrier, and now people are allowed to receive, even if they're not pious enough to receive very nicely, they're allowed to receive the holy name. So these are the three ways which one can be corrected, and the time factor again is a little imperceptible, in the sense that gradually we age, and sometimes we become ill, and no one actually likes to be ill. Right, Veda? No one likes to have aches and pains in their body. Nobody wants it. And yet somehow or other it will come. It will come to all of us in due course of time. We say that so many times, in due course of time. And they have made all kinds of foolish ideas, like they talk about killing time. Right? We'll kill some time now. So they don't realize that actually, in fact, they are killing some time. By their waste of the time, they're killing it. But they're not killing time, in the sense they're killing themselves by their wasting of the time. So let us continue. Does anyone have any questions on this particular purport? If not, we will move to the next. Any points? Alright, the next one says, the translation is, fools like me, who proudly think themselves universal lords, quickly give up their conceit and directly take to the path of the spiritually progressive when they see you are fearless even in the face of time. So this is somehow or other what touched Indra. When he saw that in the face of time Krishna was so fearless, he said, fools like him who think themselves lords, we all think ourselves lords, not lords, lords and ladies, not lords and ladies like Indra and his wife, but of some merit. We all have our little status in our own little way, so we have a little lordship in our own little universal domain, something significant about each one of us. But we would be able to give up our conceit and take more directly to the path of the spiritually progressive if we could see how Krishna is fearless even in the face of time. So this is an interesting concept, because I don't think it's a concept that any of us, do you think like this? Would like to see how Krishna is fearless in the face of time? Or do you just sort of assume that, I guess he's whatever he is, whatever I am. But here Indra was actually able to see this, because he was ruthless in his exhibition of his pride, and he called forth the maximum amount of strength and violence that he had under his control, and that was his clouds. And these particular clouds, because Indra, he's the predominator of the rain, as we know, he has these powerful clouds that can completely inundate. Not just have a heavy rain, like sometimes we see in Melbourne or we see in India during the rainy season, it can rain very heavily. But the description in the Bhagavatam is that the rain was coming down like a river falling down. So just imagine if somebody was so powerful, they could take the river Ganga, which is so wide, and just tip it up like that on your head. How would you feel? You'd be totally washed away. And this is just one little river. Indra is going to can do that, devastate the whole universe with his power. So there he is, and he himself became frightened, because this power of his had no effect. It had so little effect that we read in the Bhagavatam that all the deer and the wild hogs and the other animals on Govardhan Hill, where he was going to perform this violent act, they all climbed up to the top of the hill, and the hill was in the clouds. It was lifted up so high, and they were all just sitting there, and they had no ill effect whatsoever from all this devastating rain of Indra. In fact, after the rainfall, everything in Braj was really sparkly and nice. Who has been to Vrindavan in the rainy season? Yes. Has anyone noticed how, anyone who has the good fortune to do that, to see how everything becomes sparkling? And the trees get new, fresh green leaves, and everything looks clean, not the dustiness that we see after the summer. So Indra, in a sense, it was as if his violent activity turned out to be just another a good deed he did, a favor he did to the residents of Vrindavan, because they all sheltered underneath. Krishna didn't even bother to chastise him. If somebody was, a child was misbehaving in the room here, and we turned it all into a kirtan, and the child is loudly making And instead of stopping everything to correct the child, we had a joyful kirtan and ignored the child. Then the child feels it's not very fair. I'm making my statement. You're supposed to register it and you're supposed to be disturbed by me. I'm making a disturbance. You should be disturbed. But Krishna was not disturbed. He was completely, he ignored, oblivious to Indra, and performed a wonderful leela pastime instead. So Indra is embarrassed, and he says, "Thus you punish the mischievous only to instruct them." Now here is the purport of the seventh text. History is filled with examples of the supreme authority breaking the conceit of foolish men. One time I read a comment by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who had an uncompromising intelligence, and he saw everything from the absolute platform, and he was very, very cutting when he would present the truth. He didn't disguise his point in eloquent words. He spoke very precise, just like a man who's cutting wood, is sawing, sawing, sawing straight. He doesn't go here or there. So he was talking about what is the value of modern education, and he was first of all pointing out that modern education was useless, because in modern education it was teaching people to forget God. But he said if modern education has any relevance, any significance for history, for example, by studying history you can see all the mistakes that people have made and all the calamities that have occurred as a result of their indifference to the supreme authority. So he would target everything from this one point. And here the same point is being made. People don't see history like that. They see conquests and they see calamities, but they don't understand this vital point that it is going on in defiance of the supreme. Modern world leaders proudly fight one another, placing the common people in unprecedented jeopardy. Similarly, Indra, proud of his apparently illustrious position, dared to threaten the lives of the innocent residents of Vrindavan with terrible weapons, until his arrogance was curbed by the dynamic response of the Supreme Lord. So he did something so dynamic. Who would think of doing such a thing? If there was a great rain, to run over and pick up a hill and tell everybody to go underneath. And underneath the hill there weren't all kinds of rock clusters falling down and the roots of trees and dirt all over everywhere and sort of wet and moldy under there and damp and uncomfortable. But when he lifted the hill up, underneath the hill was a beautiful valley, even more beautiful than the surrounding areas of Vrindavan. And there were barley fields for the cows, and there were beautiful pavilions and jeweled pathways, and everything was like a pleasure garden underneath. And still the residents of Vrindavan hardly noticed that, because they were so preoccupied with Krishna. So they were under there in the most divinely heavenly environment, and above is Indra with his clouds forcing down the inundation, but it's having no effect. Nowadays, governments in the Western countries tend to be elected democratically, and thus the mass of people become identified with the destinies of their leaders. When the proud leaders engage in violence, the people who elected them bear the brunt of such belligerent decisions. Thus, the people in the democratic nations of the world should elect Krishna-conscious rulers who will establish an administration consonant with the laws of God. If they fail to do so, their materialistic leaders, oblivious of the will of the Supreme Lord, will undoubtedly be chastised by the cataclysmic events, and the people who elected such leaders, being responsible for their leaders' acts, will share in the suffering. It is ironic that modern democracies do not do the leaders. It is ironic in modern democracies. Not only do the leaders consider themselves universal controllers, but the mass of people, considering the leaders merely their representatives, rather than the representatives of God, also consider themselves as a people to be the controllers of their nation. So here is an interesting point. Everyone thinks they're a controller. I elected that person, they should do this for me. These are my parents, they should do this for me. This should do this for me, it should all be done for me. Why not? Why? No, why not? Why? Because do you know who I am? I'm me. So it should all work this way. It'll work better if it works this way. In fact, this is the problem. It is not working correctly because you haven't understood what I want and how I want it to be. And if you fix that, it will work nicely. In the family, we all think like this. In the community, people think like this. This is the mentality, especially of those who have a little influence. They want it their way. Thus, the chastisement mentioned in this verse has become unprecedentedly applicable to all the people in general in this modern world. I remember myself personally at a younger age when Srila Prabhupada had requested us to be serving him in Hong Kong, and it was difficult and the maturity wasn't there to do the job properly. And so over time I found myself lapsing backwards towards what were my previous interests and tastes and so forth. And so then I started taking things into my own hands personally. My husband is here and I'm here and I want something to do, so I want to do this and I feel like doing that, and I took my own course for a period of time. And when Srila Prabhupada came to Hong Kong to correct the situation, which had moved off its orbit, the first person he corrected was me, and quite strongly and quite forcibly, in a shockingly apparent way, because wives like to hide a little behind their husband when there's some fault, and they like to stand a little in front when they've done something that's worthy of attention. So now it was the time for moving behind, but Srila Prabhupada didn't allow it. He actually pointed me out publicly in the middle of a meeting. He talked to my husband, talked to me right in front of everyone. This was, to me, it was totally unethical to do this. But he wanted to remove some false pride. So he asked me a question. And it was a very simple question. But it was a very weighty question, because the fact was that I was not following the process of Krishna consciousness in the way he had given. So he asked a very simple question in front of everyone present, everyone that we had ever met and encouraged to come. He looked at me quite firmly but pleasantly and said to me, "Jagatarini," and I thought, oh no. I looked at him and he said, "What do you think about lifestyle?" And I sat there and I looked at him and I could feel my arrogance looking back at him. It was quite a shocking experience. I was looking back at him and he was meeting my gaze, and he was looking back at me and I was looking at him, and I didn't want to look left or right because I knew everybody else was also looking at me to hear my answer. And it was very telling because I was not living the lifestyle properly. So when he asked this simple question, that moment appeared like a very long time to me. And I finally thought very quickly in my consciousness and thought, what should I do here? If I say, "I think it's very nice," or something like that, then it's obvious what he will say next. And if I say, "I don't think it's very nice," then I will be in greater trouble still. So I sat there for a moment and looked at him, and not knowing what to do, I said, "I don't know." I didn't say, "I don't know." I said, "I don't know," which seemed to indicate, "I don't think I know, do I?" And Srila Prabhupada took it the other way. He said, "I don't know. You don't know? You don't know." I don't know. I shouldn't have said that. And Srila Prabhupada looked very, very intensely at me. He said, "You don't know." And I looked back at him and he said, "You don't know. You are teaching others. You don't know and you are teaching others. You are following a fool. You are following a cheater and you are cheating others. You don't know. It was like, oh, it was so painful. And it was, again, it was like Krishna being chastising to Indra. Nobody really in the room, they all looked at me for a moment and then they went on with their own thoughts. But for me, it was a complete exposure to everybody else's consciousness. And it was impossible for me to understand that they were not holding on to it, as I was holding on to this great humiliating experience of Srila Prabhupada chastising me. And he didn't like make it, he had sometimes he'd chastise and then he would make something light at the end, so you thought, oh, never mind. But it wasn't like that. He didn't release the tension on his words. So I sat there through the rest of the class. I don't know how I did it. I must have used all my skills at imitating the fact that I was all right, and I sat there, and then as soon as possible I rushed from the room and hid somewhere and cried forcefully in embarrassment and humiliation that he would do this to everyone, because he was doing this to me to remove some false pride. But it was so painful. And because I was asserting myself, here's my husband and here's me, I want to do this, I want to do this, so he chastised us equally. Just as we hear here that if the government is elected by the people, and the people are arrogant, they want their way, they want this and this and this and this, they elect the government, then equally they're all chastisable, because they're all actually thinking, this is for me, this is for me, I want this, I want that, give me this, give me that. So Krishna chastised all of them, will chastise all of them as he chastised Indra. So after that personal experience, which never left a very powerful mark on my consciousness, we went through various different phases of this time frame, and again we found ourselves in a situation where perhaps Srila Prabhupada would be displeased. And I said to my husband, if Srila Prabhupada is displeased with me again, if I listen to you, and Srila Prabhupada is displeased with me again, I don't think I could bear that again. Of course it was good for my humility, but it was also extremely painful. I don't think I want to put myself back into that position. So he said to me at that time, and it was interesting, he said to me, if you listen to me and do what I say, if I'm wrong, he'll chastise me, but he won't chastise you. And I didn't have full confidence in this, but at the same time I obeyed it. So we came to Australia in 1974. This is of course all in the book, My Glorious Master. But we came to see Srila Prabhupada. He was staying in Elwood. One devotee was giving his home. And we had left Hong Kong without his permission. That was the offence. And so we were waiting outside to come and see him, and I was feeling some trepidation because I knew we were supposed to be in Hong Kong right now, but we had chosen to leave. So when we came into the room, we were waiting outside, and Satsarup Maharaj, who was his secretary, he came out and he said, Srila Prabhupada has finished with his breakfast, you can come in now. I didn't want to go in. So, my husband has gone outside to say his Gayatri Mantra, when he comes back we'll go in. And he said, no, don't keep Srila Prabhupada waiting, just you go in. So here we were, again, having done something disobedient, and I had to go in. So I walked in and I paid my obeisances and I sat up and I thought of what my husband had said, and I looked at Srila Prabhupada in the face, just sitting there, me and him. He was behind the table, I'm sitting right in front of it. I looked at him, I looked at his face, and there was no sign of any anger. There was nothing, there was only a very gentle, grandfatherly look on his face. And then he sat for some moments and then he looked over at me and he said, why is your husband doing this? And I said, I don't know, Prabhupada. And he went, and then he was waiting to give him his words of correction. But for me there was no need to correct me because I was submissive. Now, having learnt in the painful way, submissive to the system that was in place. So here Indra is coming. He wants to now become submissive to the system in place, that he's a demigod and the supreme controller is Krishna himself. He says, engrossed in pride over my ruling power and ignorant of your majesty, I was also ignorant of Srila Prabhupada's position at that time. I offended you. Oh, my Lord, may you forgive me. My intelligence was bewildered. Let my consciousness never again be so impure. So it's sobering to see that actually later his consciousness did become impure again. So it's not so easy to give up false pride. It's not that you just say, please take away my false pride, and in 1 second or two it will all be gone. One has to be vigilant. And maybe there'll be further examples to keep one on their toes. So here in the purport this is mentioned, that although Krishna protected the residents of Braj by lifting Govardhan Hill, he had not yet punished Indra, and Indra feared that at any moment Krishna might call the son of Vibhiswan Yamaraj, who punishes impudent persons who defy the law of God. Indra was really frightened. He hadn't been punished. He didn't get chastised yet. Indra was very fearful, and he begged the Lord's forgiveness on the plea that he could only be purified by Krishna's mercy, and that he was too stubborn to learn a good lesson through mere punishment. Ah, how clever is that? I won't learn my lesson by punishment. So, and I will learn my lesson through mercy, so please give me your mercy. Let's make this work successful from all concerned. So he was very shrewd in the way he was presenting himself. And perhaps because of that, he made the mistake again. Mm-hmm. Perhaps he cleverly avoided the punishment, and therefore the false pride was not removed. It's a possibility. In fact, despite Indra's humility in this case, his heart was not completely purified. There it is. Later on in this canto, we find that when Lord Krishna once took a parijat flower from Indra's kingdom, poor Indra again reacted violently against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, we should aspire to go back to our eternal home in the kingdom of Krishna and should not become entangled in the imperfect life of the material gods. So we should not try to become a material god and enjoy here. As long as we try, we will be acting on the basis of false ego, and as long as we have this false ego, which we all have, this is the fact, but as we can nourish our false ego, or we can try to gently cause our false ego to reduce in size. This is the choice. We cannot say, I don't want a false ego, I have one already. False ego, a false identification, an attachment to the present, who I think I am. But we can become entangled more and more in the imperfect life of trying to enjoy, or we can diminish that by trying to take up the practices of spiritual life. So this choice is all of ours, and it's one we carry with us throughout not only this life, we carry it with us as long as we have a life in the material world. On one side it's very heavy that I'm carrying this weight of responsibility for myself and others, and on the other side it's very wonderful that to the degree I wish to become released from this, Krishna immediately will assist with this. He's not lazy. He's not idle. He's very much more anxious than we that we should come to him and be eternally situated in pure happiness. So thank you. Are there any questions? Yes,
Prabhu. This is more point of view. You said something that cataclysm attack.
Cataclysmic. Something about something cataclysmic, yes. Yes, cataclysmic. Will undoubtedly be chastised by cataclysmic events.
What does it mean?
Cataclysm means, does anyone have a full dictionary definition? Disasters, catastrophes. Basically. See, it's just, I was talking to my mother yesterday, and she was, because she was born just after the First World War. So we hear of a war And I said to her something about the war, and she said, well, it wasn't just one war, it took place in stages. So we're expecting that everything's fine because there's not a total devastation of all of civilization. But if you were to look on at the newspaper regularly, you'd see there's something happening over here and something happening over there. And and now with the Arabs and the petrol, something's happening. There's things happening. It's boiling and brewing. And as long as we can get to work, make money, eat well, we think everything's fine. This is how people think. It's a bit of a problem over there, some other place in the world, but actually we're not really having such a hard time. It's not so difficult for us. We're getting a good time. We've got lots of money and so on and so forth. But actually, if you look at it, if you go up above and look at the whole planet, you would see that it's all the time being affected by cataclysmic things because of people's sinful activities. And when it drops on your head, like we were hearing about the piano and God on the computer, the piano waiting to press the enter button, this is some people's idea, when it drops on your head when you're walking underneath and up, there it goes, then we think, what a disaster. What is God doing to me? Who does he think he is to do this? People will think indignantly like that. But when it's over there on the other side of the world, it's not such a problem. But if we were over there on the other side of the world, it would be. So one time, one gentleman said to me when I was living in Vrindavan during the Kuwait wars, when they were burning all the oil refineries and there were huge fires and bombings, he said, if it was not for the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, you may have taken your birth in Kuwait. And it suddenly it became relevant, rather than thinking it's just something over there. And maybe it's a little relevant from the oil prices or something, but it's very, very, it's actually like that. Material world isn't a place that you can have long-term happiness, and certainly not peace. So yes, this is a cataclysmic event, another one, so many of them. Any other questions or points? Yes?
I was going to say, doesn't, when you start too much, doesn't it dull the consciousness? You can't remember anything anymore, and you're more ignorant than before.
Yes, that's there. But there's something imperceptible that happens at the time that you're suffering, is that you're wearing off something. It's like as if something's being filed away. Just like if you were made of stone and somebody wanted to chisel something, a wonderful deity out of you, and you're a block of stone. First of all, they'd start getting a hammer and wedging out pieces of you. You'd feel it. And then they'd start filing away, filing away, filing away, and you would feel that too. But if you were, of course, stone doesn't have the position to jump up and run away, but we do. But if you don't jump up and run away, and you let the filing process continue, even though it's painful, and you might yourself not be able to feel any benefit whatsoever, any illumination from it whatsoever, when it's finished, you might find that there's something wonderful there. But we have to stay, that's the whole part. We have to stay, like Prabhupada would say, you dedicate this life, you stay, don't go, don't avoid the file, because the file in the hands of the master craftsman is going to produce something more beautiful, more valuable and more valid than just a piece of rock, which may have nice features to it, nice veins and colours in it. But the carving has to be there as part of the endeavor. So endurance is developed actually by staying even when you're dulled by the pain. Krishna notices it. He notices that. And also sometimes the reward isn't going to come in this life. So we feel that maybe this is meaningless suffering. The reward comes in the next life. And next life you don't know, we don't know why we get good fortune, we don't know why we get bad fortune. But we say yes to good fortune and no to bad fortune. So if, even though we won't know why, we're working towards a better future, we'll appreciate it when it comes. Yeah? Any other questions?
When we think about Melbourne, why it was so rigid? Is it because of cow slaughtering of the cows and the things? Why it was so difficult
to start in Melbourne? Melbourne's a very Vedic city, much more Vedic than Sydney. Sydney's a more spontaneous place, so if you do something foolish or whimsical in Sydney, they will treat it one way, but Melbourne runs on very much on rules and regulations. And even you can see the characteristics of the temple is like that. It's a big structure, very responsible temple. So there's something to do with the character of the city there, that the devotees were defying by their presence the rules of the city, the rules of this and so on and so forth. So it took them some time to they did the same thing in Sydney, but in a different way. They were quite active in Sydney to stop the devotees as well. And also I think in Adelaide and other places initially. I saw some pictures actually of I don't know whether it was on a video I was looking at or whether it was in these articles, but there's some pictures of the devotees and they looked really strange. Some people had odd socks on, you know. they were quite saris and they were all kind of like this and dancing in ecstasy. And I was thinking when I looked at them, I could understand why they did it. At the time I couldn't. But now looking back, we've acquired a little more dignity. We've acquired a little more of the culture, the Indian culture. We wear saris and kurtas and so on and so forth. They didn't wear saris. They were pieces of cloth wrapped in a particular way, and dhotis they didn't have. So now, and then we've mixed now with Indian people quite nicely for some time, so that some of the culture has sort of settled into the temple and into the... But the devotees were really enthusiastic, and the city was very determined to keep this off the streets. Then they gave rules. You walk, and if you stop, then we can arrest you. If you keep walking, we won't arrest you, because we had to have some rights. And gradually, Melbourne people have become familiar. And now, of course, we have so many good things that we offer to the Melbourne city, that with the restaurants and so forth like that, and festivals, that were an acceptable part. But it was breaking ice, and Melbourne was a little icy. I remember when we go on Harinam, one time I remember it being on the end of the Harinam, because I didn't practice Krishna consciousness very much in Melbourne, because I went to Sydney and then overseas. So I came back for a visit in 1972, and we were on Harinam, and this big burly gentleman kind of grabbed by the arm and pulled the last one. I was on the end, and then, you know, four strong brahmacharis come up and say, you know, stop. And he says, I've got my, you know, and he's writing down, you know, reports and giving tickets and everything, you know. But they were really rough in the 70s. But later on, it settled by the determination of the devotees to keep maintaining Krishna consciousness here in Melbourne. Alright, if there are no more questions, thank you very much. Lord Premanandi.